All right, so it is 1 o'clock, and we've reconvened for this afternoon session. And before I have John introduce our next item, just to give you an idea of time, we were looking at possibly, wrapping up around 3:30. Some of you have to travel distances, of course. Whatever amount of time need to spend, you're certainly welcome to do that. But I just wanted to give you an idea of, the timetable we were looking at to kind of calibrate our time. So, John, would you please introduce the next item?
So this is item 17, and this is not your run-of-the-mill typical item. This item, well, typically we bring you items, we present a challenge, and we try to propose a solution. It's a nice box. This one is larger. We've talked about chemicals of emerging concern before at this level. We've had this dialogue. I've been aware of this dialogue for 15 years. It's a measure of the complexity, I think, of the issue that we don't see a large-scale progress in limiting these chemicals in our environment, in our water supply, in our groundwater. So, Harvey Packard has a presentation and has prepared a staff report. Essentially, you can break these constituents into small bins. There are different chemical groups. And then I think ultimately strategies to deal with these will follow those smaller groups. Today's discussion is meant to focus on the prevalence of CDCs in the environment and what, if anything, the regional board can do with it. And then on a larger context, what we as individuals might be able to do, within the societal level, not our water board roles.
Stop using any healthcare products. Take any medication.
Take on the pharmaceutical industry.
I mean, stop using all of the
Just this
chemicals.
afternoon, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll finish that off this
Yeah,
afternoon.
take on the $3.8 billion pharmaceutical industry
Yeah.
just
I mean,
in California
I'll
alone.
stop drinking coffee, okay?
Individually, we, have to stop being part of
Right.
this
Right. Yeah.
modern culture that we have created,
We, yeah,
in terms of use of artificially made substances.
Right. And I mean, how we deal with them, how we dispose of them, do
Yeah.
we take them? As we talked about this internally, not to cut to the chase too much or spoil the ending, but it's got to get to the front end of the discussion, not the back end. It shouldn't be a wastewater treatment solution. It has to be a preventative or proactive
Correct.
solution.
Yeah.
It's a cultural thing. There's avoidance things that we need to put in place rather than trying to. It is incredibly expensive and unrealistic, actually, to deal with it on the back end. And so, as we talked about this item, we talked about there's three critical pieces that have to exist in this process of dealing with CDCs. One is what's in our water. So there's this data component. We have to understand what are the CDCs, what is that universe, and then we go to the bin concept that I said, okay, now we break them into groups. The second step is, so what effect do these CDCs have on human health and ecological health? And that is a research component. So we have data research. And then there is that action. I think Harvey characterizes it as this action component. Okay, so now understanding what's in our water and what the ecological or human health component is, what's our subsequent action? Should we allow this into the system? We talked about this earlier today, actually. Should that be a chemical that we even consider? TCE, I'll use as an example, or DDT as an example. Or should the way we handle it be different? Or should we just rely on some sort of treatment to help us? Now, understanding most of the treatment technologies that are in play right now don't destroy the compound. They just relocate the compound, like RO is sort of the step, one of the stopgap strategies. Well, there's a brine that's coming off that's just a concentrate of everything we didn't want in our drinking water. It still has to be dealt with somehow. Usually it's dealt with as a waste stream. Okay, and then if we have time, I'd also like to maybe consider how can we become better educated? This isn't part of those three steps. This is about us collectively better educating ourselves back in our capacity as water board members and staff, and the opportunity exists for us to have educational field trips to learn more about wastewater process and how things are or aren't being dealt with. We're sort of mashing two ideas together, an information item, and then also planning educational field trip opportunities that might be an outgrowth of this item. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Harvey Packard.
And before doing that, you may want to mention that we originally had planned to have a guest presenter, and, you know, the unfortunate...
Right,
availability.
Jeff Densmuir. Yes. Okay, he is no longer here. Jeff is part of a division of drinking water, State Water Board, came over in about 2 years ago, the division did. And Jeff was here. He's from the Carpinteria office. He's the manager of the Carpinteria office of the division of drinking water. He was here earlier today. He had to leave at noon. He promised that if we had questions that stumped us that might be Division of Drinking Water, we could email them to him, and he'll give us... No. And we could get solicit answers from him there. That's who you're referencing, right? Oh, yeah. Ito McGowan. Thank you for Dr. McGowan. Dr. McGowan is a frequent participant in our Santa Barbara meetings and has an astounding amount of knowledge with respect to pathogenic. All right. And that's about me. Pathogenic compounds. And, and he's unable to be here, but he submitted a component to our staff report. It's an attachment to the staff report. And it's unfortunate that when we finally have an item that he is mainstream to, he's unable to attend. But he wanted to include that package. Thanks for the reminder. Okay. With that, I'll turn it over to Harvey Packard. Right. That was part of the last time.
Okay, thanks, John. So today we're talking about CECs, and I'm going to use several acronyms. CEC is one of them. You can call those chemicals or compounds or constituents of emerging concern. Another often used acronym or initialism is EDCs, endocrine disrupting compounds. Yeah. PPCPs, pharmaceutical and personal care products. So those you will see all of those in some of the slides I have today. So the staff report, I grouped the discussion around four types of water that we find CECs in: wastewater, recycled water, ambient waters, and groundwaters, or ambient surface waters and ambient groundwaters. Most of the discussion was about surface water. In the presentation today, I'd like to split it up a little bit differently and go with the bins that John was talking about, more about some information about the data and occurrence and prevalence, some monitoring that we see, and then maybe some actions that we can take. Also, you should have in your folder, I think, 5 printouts. These are slides from the presentation today. They're really busy, so I thought it'd be a good idea if you have them in front of you and you can actually read them. I'm not sure we can all read the screen here. This is a slide from a presentation I saw at a conference I went to about a year ago in Berkeley as part of one of the technical panels on indirect potable reuse. And they had a scientist talking about this very topic, what to do about the CECs when we're talking about recycled water. And so he presented this. It's some of the data is a little bit old, but I think it's really illuminating. On the left, you can see a few bullets there. We have hundreds of thousands of chemicals. We know we have toxicity data for very few of them, relatively speaking. On the right side of the chart, it groups chemicals in different types of categories. For instance, the top one is pesticides, and then has a bar chart. And so that's the estimated mean percent of that category that we have information, toxicity information about. So the orange is the percentage that we know we have complete health hazard assessment on. So for pesticides in 1984, we had good health hazard assessment on 10% of the known pesticides. I'm not sure what the information is as of today. And if you include partial health hazard assessment information, we had information on 35% of pesticides, meaning 65% we basically didn't know much about at all. And these are in-use chemicals. The second category is cosmetic ingredients, third one is drugs, fourth one, food additives. That's kind of interesting. Of 8,600 food additives in 1984, we had good health hazard assessment for 19% of food additives. So I put that up there just to give you an idea of the scope of the issue we're talking about. A lot of chemicals and not a lot of toxicological data. This is a slide from that same presentation, a little bit updated. Some of you may be familiar with the Chemical Abstract Registry. It's a listing of all known chemicals known to man. Everyone's supposed to put their discoveries into there. There's over 100 million in there. The last bullet says that maybe we're using about 30 or 40,000 chemicals in commercial use in the U.S. and Canada today. New ones all the time. So that's a little background. I'd like to go now to a few case examples, and some of these are from our region, so I think it's kind of interesting. I want to talk about a groundwater study that was done in Los Osos in 2006. This is the cover page. These are groundwater samples taken from monitoring wells, shallow zone monitoring wells. These are not from drinking water wells. Next page is some results. They tested a bunch of emerging contaminants. And I highlighted a couple there. The top one is carbamazepine, which is a pharmaceutical anticonvulsant. Second one is sulfamethoxazole antibiotic. And then if you look down on the bottom row, you see MDMA. MDMA is a chemical used in manufacturing, in rocket motors, and it can be a disinfection byproduct also. What the source is in shallow groundwater in Los Osos, I'm not sure. I put this slide in here to demonstrate that these things are in the environment. And septic systems apparently are probably the source in this particular case. The concentrations that we're talking about are probably well below anything that the experts would say are harmful, but it does indicate that they are out in the environment. There's a few other detections you might notice down there that I didn't highlight. One of them, it was found in the blanks as well in the as well as in the monitoring well, so that's probably a lab error of some sort.
Can you repeat that? What did you just say?
There are a few detections that I didn't go over because I'm not sure they're real. For instance, one of them, if you look across the row, there are detections in the lab blanks. So that's indicative of a sampling, glassware, or laboratory type error introducing the contaminant. In the staff report, one of the links was to a study of done in Morro Bay of normal phenol concentrations in gobies and other fishes and other organisms. The study was published in 2012, but this article came out in the San Francisco New Times in 2009, where they talked to the poly professors doing it and had some preliminary results. About 20% of the gobies that they netted in Morro Bay had tumors. At first, they thought they were pregnant. They looked closely, and they had tumors. The tumors were full of nonylphenol. Nonylphenol is a known endocrine disrupting chemical, and was found to be biomagnifying up into the food chain. It's found in, it's a surfactant and used in manufacturing processes. It's found in soaps, actually found in toilet paper. And Karen was telling me a kind of interesting fact about the toilet paper. It's more prevalent in recycled toilet paper. So the higher the content of your toilet paper that's recycled, the higher the nonylphenol concentration is. So you're thinking you're doing a good thing, right, using recycled toilet paper, but as Chair Wolf likes to say, those unintended consequences sometimes, right?
Can you explain that? I mean, is that because it's compounding? Is there something that's latent within?
I'm assuming it's used in the recycling process.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Part of the process, and it's used in other application with our pulp and paper industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically to help dissolve the cellulose fibers, so that they can repress them and reconstitute them. You have the same issue with post-consumed paper bags.
Right.
And post-consume wine trays.
Right, which hopefully are either being recycled again or in the landfill. In this case, toilet paper ends up in our wastewater treatment plants and in the environment. So getting back to what Jeff was saying earlier, you know, what can we do? What personal choices can we make when we think we're making one good choice and it may or may not be the best choice for the environment? It's hard to know sometimes.
I guess we have to stop using toilet paper. No other options we have.
Leaves, yeah.
No, in the old country, it was newspapers.
Yeah, I lived in
Oklahoma,
not the West Coast.
Yes. Yeah. If you go to Japan, they're abhorred that we would use dry paper for that task. They don't. So it's not like an industrial or non-developed versus developed issue. There are choices out there, but sometimes our cultural bias close our minds to options because we're so ingrained in how we do things.
Okay, on to the next one. I don't think any recommendations there. I'll leave that up to you. This is a slide that you first saw in May 2015 when we were talking about nitrate in Morro Bay groundwater. I'm not going to talk about nitrate today, but there's some other interesting things we see on the slide. This is a map of Morro Bay. You see Highway 101, or Highway 1, coming up through the middle of town. Highway 41 coming to the west here. The wastewater treatment plant is right about here. There's most of the results on the page are well sample results. This result right here is raw wastewater taken from a manhole. You see it has caffeine in it, and it has sucralose. Another interesting box is this one right here, state water, raw state water being delivered to customers. Again, has a little bit of caffeine in it and sucralose. And then the rest of the boxes are groundwater results. interesting thing is that there's no or very little caffeine in those, but the sucralose is consistent throughout them. If the concentration's pretty similar no matter where you look, and a lot of those are drinking water wells.
So what is sucralose?
Sucralose is an artificial sweetener.
Right, okay.
Yeah, it's, and we used it in this graph because it's a very, very efficient tracer. It does not degrade in the environment. Caffeine is a good tracer, but it degrades a lot faster than sucralose.
This is from the project you did when we were trying to identify alleged leaks in the sewer system.
Right. The conclusion was that the nitrate concentrations were not caused by leaks in the sewer system. Sucralose, I don't have a good answer for why there's sucralose in all groundwater wells in Morro Bay. It's probably got something to do with state water. But again, the point here is just illustrating that the ubiquity of some of these chemicals.
But the source of state water is because state water provided some of it is impacted by recycled water discharge into
exactly.
The streams.
Yeah, the intakes for state water are below several very, very large wastewater discharges into the Sacramento River. But just thinking about it now, I guess one of the results of the water fix that the administration is talking about, where the intakes would be moved north of Sacramento, might help resolve some of that situation. Karen's mentioning that water supply in Morro Bay is also from wells in the Trail Valley, which could be drawing in wastewater recycled from the CMC. It would depend on, they only use groundwater in Morro Bay for about 2 weeks a year, so it's almost always state water in their drinking water systems. But yeah, there could be more than one source. This is the really hard one to see, and I think even your printouts didn't come out very well, which I apologize for. But I mentioned in the staff report that the drinking water regulations do not require sampling for CECs. We have at least one water supplier in our region that does do CEC sampling, and that's the city of Santa Cruz. So this is the results of 6 events that the city did on both water in their water supply and in raw water mostly from the San Lorenzo River. City of Santa Cruz is primarily surface water supply. Primarily the San Lorenzo River. So, I can't read it either, so I'm going to have to go on memory here. But there's 2 chemicals listed in blue, which were the ones most prevalently detected, and they're both artificial sweeteners. Right. I remember when we were talking with some of the Morro Bay people about this, someone asked if there is a drinking water standard for these artificial sweeteners. Said, I don't think so. The FDA allows you to dump as much as you want into your coffee, and they're probably not going to establish a drinking water limit based on health.
Is there any demonstrated concern about these sweeteners?
Not that I know of. And again, the concentrations here are really low. I mean, what you see in your cup of coffee compared to this is many, many orders of magnitude.
Yeah, because this you get down to parts per trillion.
Yeah.
And when you put it in your cup of coffee, it's grams per liter.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it's like a trillion magnitude.
Right. Huge difference.
Now, I know to supplement a little bit your question, I know there have been studies done on some of your artificial sweeteners and in a laboratory animal test, they had shown that, you know, there was some health impact, but The results were rejected by the manufacturing industry, saying, well, it's not representative because for an adult human, that would be equivalent of taking an unreasonably large dose, but there have been no shown effects, but in large quantities.
Similar to caffeine.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Some of the other chemicals that they detected, the ones in green are from one first flush event that they did, and there's some pharmaceuticals and some herbicides in that one. And then the ones in black are ones that were detected on a more regular basis in raw water and finished water, and includes a few more ag chemicals and pharmaceuticals. DEET is in there, for example. That's usually a good indicator they found in the environment.
So, Harvey, is this from, let's see, sampling locations? Some of this is kind of like a surface water type thing.
Right.
And others are.
So, the first column in each of those events is taken from the water supply system itself. The other columns in each event are different sources of surface water, mostly
okay.
San Lorenzo River. My
printout, I don't know if yours is this way, the labeling is off.
Yeah.
The vertical labeling
right.
is off, so it's hard to kind of pick that out. Right here.
And if anyone would like a copy of the original sources, I can email those. I'll just send you an electronic, and you can blow it up to whatever size you want. Yeah. I don't know if you have the paper. Yeah, I'll send the whole paper, the whole report.
Yeah, because the columns are.
Yeah.
The way it is on ours, that you can't really read the columns or tops of the columns.
Right.
So, is there DEET in the water people are drinking in Santa Cruz?
There's DEET in San Lorenzo River, yes.
The river, is that, okay. That first column is the river water?
No, the first column is finished water. So was there DEET in that one also?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So again, there's one of those choices, not necessarily in Santa Cruz, but if you're living in Fort Lauderdale and you don't want Zika, you're going to put DEET on. But it's going to end up in wastewater.
Actually distributed to the schools.
Yeah.
And of course that's just a couple of chemicals. I mean, if we really look to try to identify everything, we would find
right.
a lot more of this in there.
Santa Cruz sample, they tested for 96, and these are the detections.
Okay. Any endocrine disruptors? Anything like that? Hormones? Where is it?
Yeah,
BPA would be an EDC, yeah.
Okay. How about any of the artificial hormones?
I don't recall seeing any of those in that list. I can't even see it. Anything else, or should we move on?
Go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to mention a study that hasn't occurred yet. USGS is planning starting next year in 2017, to do a very large study of surface water bodies in California. And it'll include streams from the Bay Area down into Southern California, including Santa Maria and Salinas watershed streams. They'll collect 6 weekly samples for water quality, sediment tissue, and they'll do bioassessments. and a very large list of analytes, including pesticides, PPCC, pharmaceuticals and personal care products, endocrine disrupting chemicals, nutrients, and a whole big list. So that should give us a lot of good information.
But when we look at those, though, in many instances with some of these chemicals and compounds, 10 years ago, recently, but lab equipment was not sensitive enough to pick up these. So, you know, increasingly, as we have more sophistication in laboratory equipment, you know, we used to consider parts per billion being, you know, the gold standard. Now we're in beyond the parts per trillion, and as we increase our ability to detect, you know, that's something to also put in a frame of reference, is that we're able to detect more now because of the higher sensitivity of the lab equipment.
Right. And because of that, it's more easily to get maybe alarmed past the point we should be for some of these chemicals. These are very, very, very low detections.
Exactly. That's my point.
Quick question. Do the wadable streams in the Salinas watershed include the Salinas River?
Karen says yes.
So likely San Luis Obispo County then.
So when does this start?
2017.
And it's going to be a 1 year, 2 year study?
I think just 1 year.
And what was USGS's motivation to do this?
This is Karen. They do this type of study throughout the country. They just happen to be doing it in California. So it's just great that we're getting it. It's an incredible opportunity for us to, I mean, the analyte list is maybe even 1,000. There's hundreds and hundreds of analytes that they're testing for. So it'll really help us understand what might be an issue for us.
And is there a focus on wadable streams? Obviously it's public health, but is that a long-standing focus that they've had?
Yeah, they have a large effort monitoring wadable streams, and it's also for environmental health. They're doing all the bioassessment work, and it has a very large list of estrogenic, androgenic compounds, this study is.
Have they done this in California before, or in our Central Coast?
Not that I know of.
It would be great if staff could bring their results back to us sometime in the next two years, 3 years.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye out for the results.
Yeah, it would be great to see what they have.
So moving on to what we can do and what we can do to help our understanding grow includes monitoring. This is a slide that shows monitoring, or the CEC monitoring list for Orange County Water District's Advanced Water Treatment System. This is a very large facility. They do about 100 million gallons a day. They take the product water and inject it in the drinking water aquifer, and also use some of it as a seawater barrier down at the coast. They've been running since 2008, which predates the recycled water policy guidelines for CEC monitoring. You can see the ones in yellow are the ones that the recycled water policy indicates should be monitored for aquifer injection projects. And this is what they found. They have not had detections of hormones or other EDCs in the product water. They have had a few pharmaceutical or personal care product detections, and they've had some NDMA detections, but all is below the notification level. Orange County. Right, this is recycled wastewater, which they use for groundwater injection in the drinking water aquifer and for seawater intrusion barrier.
So my question, Harvey, what I'm looking at is the compounds that they're testing for. That's the list in its entirety. And the yellow is highlighted because it is, these are the newer constituents that have to also be monitored.
Right.
Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. When they operated this plant, they were looking at a lot of CECs as part of the recycled water policy effort by the state board, a technical panel, and advice for which a smaller group that could be safely used as indicators for the big group, and that's the ones in yellow. So when the board adopted the Cambria permit for the advanced water treatment system, these are the CECs that are in that permit. And they're required to sample annually or quarterly for these seven indicators.
So I just want to make sure I've got it. What I'm getting from this is that the RO system, at least the one, the version they're running in Orange County, seems to be relatively effective at removing these from the wastewater stream.
Exactly. Yeah, I was going to get to that conclusion. What we found in Cambria, as well as what we see in Orange County, which are basically the two main systems of this type now in California, is that the RO system and the post-RO treatment is effective at removing the CECs. And I say, great, we got rid of them. But what's happening to them? They're getting pushed into the other side stream, and they're going out into the ocean.
So they're going out of the Bryan stream?
Yep.
And, okay.
Yeah.
And so this is the, we did a field trip, didn't we, a number of years ago? To the site?
In Orange County?
In, I think it's Orange County.
I didn't go. I'm not aware of that, but that's possible.
Did you guys go? Michael, did you go? I went on a field trip. Monica, were you on the board then?
They do. Maybe it was part of the WQCC or something like that.
It was.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah.
Actually.
That was the Huntington Beach plant?
No, it was. No, this was inland. This was totally inland.
So I think the plant, if I recall, I used to live in the area. I think it's in Fountain Valley, which is inland of Costa Mesa.
Yeah.
Like 4 miles inland or so.
It's a cutting edge recharge facility coming out of sewage treatment.
Yeah, and they then reinject elsewhere in this water.
Yeah,
up in the San Gabriel River.
Big basins.
Yeah, it's a huge, huge project. They take the wastewater, they treat it, they pump it way back up the valley to spreading basins and injection wells.
Right.
They have a brine line for other desalting facilities up in the valley.
And
they have the desal area.
On our honeymoon. It was the first day of our honeymoon. We went right there.
We're such a romantic.
Yeah. And we drank the water, you know?
Yeah. It's a popular, they love to get tours, and they give you the... They show a bunch of bottles lined up, and you have to guess which one's bottled water and which one's treated wastewater. And I think their motto is, "It tastes like water because it is water."
Yeah. Well, that explains a few things, Bruce. But I think also in their requirement is that the water, before it can be extracted and to be reused for drinking water purpose, the water has to be a year old, so they do use the radioisotope monitoring to ascertain that the water is 1 year old.
Right, right. Yeah, we saw the same thing with Cambria. The requirement there is a 2-month holding time in groundwater, and they did some tracer tests. I think they're still working on finishing those tracer tests to prove that they have the 60 days.
And Orange County, they provide what they call designer water. So you actually have different grade of quality of purity that they sell. They do sell the ultra-pure RO water, which is highly corrosive to metal because it strips the ion, and that water is sold to some specialized electronic manufacturing companies. And then you can buy water with a pH being adjusted, so you have different levels in addition to, you know, the drinking water. So it's a very creative, you know, out of the box kind of program.
Right.
Well, you tell us what kind of water you want, and we'll sell it to you.
Yeah, in fact, you really got to be careful. They are finding in the groundwater aquifer where they're doing the recharge, they're getting higher arsenic. Is because of the oxidation potential of the injected water. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Changing the valence of the natural arsenic and chromium. In the staff report, I indicated that there's no statewide requirements for CEC monitoring in groundwater. The federal government does do some monitoring. They call it the UCMR rule, or Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule. And since 1996, they look at 30 contaminants each year. And I think they're about to start the fourth sample set. They finished three. And an example of one of those that was in the very first sample set was perchlorate. Remember in the late 90s, they were finding perchlorate everywhere when they started testing these large systems. Perchlorate now is not a CEC. It's regulated. It has an MCL, so it's off the CEC list and on the regulated contaminant list.
Just going to say, Harvey, just as perspective, it took from CEC list to MCL 10 years?
It takes a long time, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. Just for perspective.
And speaking of taking a long time, you may have seen the news just a couple weeks ago that the FDA banned triclosan and a few other chemicals from use in soaps. People have been pushing for that move for years and years and years, and it was a lawsuit by the NRDC that finally pushed the FDA to do this. And again, it goes back to what Jeff was talking about earlier. Personally, for years, I looked at the label on soaps and I wouldn't buy triclosan in my soap. And the data was clear, the evidence that hand washing with regular soap is just as effective as using triclosan soap. So hopefully, if you look back at that Orange County list, triclosan is one of the indicators, and hopefully we'll start seeing that number drop in the environment.
It's also bad for your hands. It breaks down the acid mantle of your own protection on your body, so it's bad all around.
What this new FDA rule doesn't do is remove it from anything but soaps. It's still in a lot of products, including at least one toothpaste. So I put this in as an example of government or agency action that can have effect on what's happening with CECs. And then we can talk about something that is even more local, which is pharmaceutical recovery programs. This is a copy of Santa Cruz County flyer for their program. San Luis Obispo County has one, and Santa Barbara County just announced that they're going to expand their drug collection program also.
I know in Monterey County, the Carmel River Watershed Conservancy has been working with local agencies to establish a pharmaceutical drop-off. But it's been a hard slog for them to get assistance. I think they finally got police stations to accept the... Because you have to have that waste permit to remove the pharmaceuticals, and you have to have control.
Right.
So I don't know how far they are with it these days.
To me, the jury's still out on how effective these are, not because it's the program themselves aren't effective at collecting pharmaceuticals, but what is the relative contribution of discarded pharmaceuticals versus pharmaceuticals that pass through our bodies and get into the system.
You know, the other compound of shown of increased concern, and I think the study started in the Bay Area, are microbeads.
Yes.
And you know, the fact that those are not effectively captured in water treatment plants,
right,
and the impact of aquatic habitat, you know, fish basically ingesting the microbeads.
Yeah. No, that's a great example of what we're, what the, that first slide I showed with all the chemicals where we don't know the effects. I mean, the marketing or the personal care product people decided it'd be a good idea to put them in there. There's no law against doing it, and then it takes years to determine the environmental effects. Very similar to that discussion we had this morning about the pesticide cycle. You know, they come up with a new pesticide and they get it out there, and then years later we figure out the environmental effects. CECs are widespread. We don't always know what the effects of them are. What can we as a board do, and what can we as citizens and personal, you know, individuals do? Monitor, advocate for things like the triclosan action, or promote things like the pharmaceutical recovery programs. There's a few examples. Most of, I'm not saying that those are really, might have a huge effect, because individuals and the board itself, I think, aren't going to have, you know, most of the things. The problem really isn't under the control of this board or any other single board or any single person. It's a larger societal issue that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with.
But you know, specifically on the pharmaceutical, you know, the state of California has a pharmaceutical board, you know, with an advisory board just like we have. It would seem to me, just, you know, kind of out of the box, that at a state board level, there should be some presentation of these data, because when initially we talked about we need to address the source rather than, you know, doing the cleanup afterward, is everybody hears about the overprescription of opioids and their effect, overprescription of antibiotics and the, you know, strain resistance impact. So when we look at the source, that's almost where it needs to begin. And, you know, on the state level, I would think that there would be an opportunity at a high level, you know, to present some of these compelling information, whereas the state board saying, you know, we can't keep up here. So you know, there needs to be that recognition, and then that'll filter all the way down to each patient, you know, who inject these, intake these products. And then the other one, I think in some cases, Harvey, is the large marketing effort made with some of these products, you know, that are sold, and how can that better be controlled? For example, you know, the marketing of soap, which are, you know, antibacterial soaps, and the phobia of some people about, you know, catching little cooties off the counter or a door handle. You know, there's also all the way to the consumer, that educational component too.
It seems like some of that, I mean, yeah, some stuff can be dealt with by either, as the FDA is doing finally with the antibacterial soap, by restricting the ingredients, or as is slowly happening with BPA and can linings and water bottles. This is non-BPA, but they have replaced the BPA probably with something else, which we don't know about yet. And some of it can be dealt with by education, the drug recycling programs, but there's a whole huge chunk of this that's going to be still going into the waste stream. I mean, I take 2-3 medications a day if you count aspirin, and 4 if you count naproxen. Naproxen was in 5 if you count caffeine. That stuff, I mean, yeah, I can take outdated stuff to a pharmacy, but most of what I'm putting in the waste stream is probably simply passing through my body. And, you know, that's not going to change. Young women are not going to stop taking birth control pills. Us older guys are not going to stop taking hormones to try to deal with prostate stuff. All that stuff's going to be going into the waste stream. You know, unless our whole practice of, you know, antibiotics are still going to be going on. So that seems like a really partial solution. I mean, the question I have is, in terms of what we do here and what we regulate, it's what's going into the sanitary sewer systems. It seems like the principal vector that we have any limited ability to impact here. And, you know, is there anything going on in terms of the ability to either in the you know, what comes out of the, to break that stuff down in the sanitary sewage systems, or to break it down in the brine, or, you know, does that stuff just, is it persistent?
I think most of the effort right now is trying to keep it out of drinking water. So with recycling water, recycling projects, they're trying to at least separate the streams. Going to the next step about trying to, you know, destroy the chemicals, I don't know how much research is going on there. Hillary was, we were talking earlier, and she mentioned, well, maybe instead of dumping in the ocean, you can put it in ponds and, you know, get it down to a solid form, crystalline, and destroy it that way somehow. I think there's research to be done there. I think another big area of research, it's very tough, yeah. A lot of research needs to be done there. What I didn't talk much about, and there's a lot of research going on, are the effects in the environment. You know, what's happening to the fish in the ocean, for instance? Can we see the effects on them? There's been, Karen and I were talking a little bit also earlier about the effects in the, you know, near wastewater outfalls, and then farther away from the outfalls on native populations. And there's a lot going on there, and we'll be learning more and more, and I'm sure there's a lot that needs to be done still in that type of research also.
You know, this is a problem that is huge, much bigger than we're ever going to be able to even begin to wrap our arms around. We're just a region within the state. We're not going to, I don't think, be able to change the way we register, certify, allow chemicals to be used. That's really where the heart of this problem lies. We don't follow the precautionary principle in this country, which they do in other countries in Europe, where, you know, you don't look at risk and make a decision whether the risk is acceptable to go ahead and allow a chemical to be used. Instead of saying, well, the burden's on the manufacturer, proponent of the chemical, to demonstrate that there's no harm that's going to be done. So years ago, we went towards the more business-oriented model that has allowed this to happen. It's not going to change. But I think what we can be doing within our region is what we can control, and that's monitoring. And I think at least we can be, we have the coastal sites that Karen spoke about. We've got groundwater too that we're doing. I think it should just be incumbent upon us to pick a few of these CECs if we're not already doing it. Maybe one from each of these different categories of things that we've got, and just start collecting the information. Because ultimately, that's what drives decision makers when they finally get to the point that there's enough information and then the science behind harm being done. Because that'll happen in time. And we can be on the forefront of that by just getting the database going in this region. So you know, that's what I would like to see us do. You know, we have different categories, the healthcare products, and you know, the medicinal products. And I'd like to see, I don't know what the cost is. A lot, huh? Yeah. Well, I think Karen is mouthing, it's a lot.
What is a lot?
Well, yeah, what is a lot,
Karen? I've never priced it. I mean, we don't have labs. We'd have to work with someone like GS to do it. So we'll learn, we're going to learn a lot with this. This project starts this winter, so it's in a few months it begins. And I think we will learn a lot. I think if we knew what would be the high-risk chemicals to sample, that's our first. I just want to throw money at it randomly. It would be good to have an indication of what would be our highest-risk problems, which we'll get out of that. So that's going to be really great. The other thing is usually when you do sampling, you do it in sort of suites of analytes. So it's not like you say, well, I'm only worried about BPA. You know, so you would write the whole suite. The suite could cost $1,000 or more
per sample. Yeah, I'm okay with a suite.
Suite's all right.
I just need one. I mean,
I can see picking, like say, in each of our rotations, picking a couple of high risk sites that have a lot of activity, whether below a wastewater treatment plant or in a heavy urban area or something, and treating them special and doing a lot.
Can we direct you, Karen, to do that?
You
or can we direct John to direct you to do that? Is there money to do that?
It's all about priorities, you know.
Well, but you're going to be pulling those samples anyway. This is just a matter of finding a lab that can do this kind of work.
We'd have to find a lab, yeah. The lab and the finances, yeah. We can do some exploratory sampling.
And pay for it, and I think prioritize judiciously where you would do this. Because, for example, on water treatment plant, within our Central Coast region, we don't have a whole lot of issue with heavy metals. However, if our region was in Sacramento area, or the Bay Area, or parts of Southern California, you have a lot of industries where you do have heavy metal that end up in the water treatment plant. So likewise, when we look at communities, I think, you know, being able to be judicious on which community would be a good sample would make a difference. You know, like you to the point where in the Silicon Valley now the Intel folks, etc., and some of the manufacturer of the silicon chips are actually harvesting, recycling the rare metals. So they're no longer discharging into the Bay Area water treatment system because the value of the rare metal is such that it can recycle it. So geographically, you know, you have some of these differences. So I think that would be a key item is where would you want to take those samples? I mean, just my input. I think Jeff is spot on, you know, so we got to start somewhere. I guess I'll call it baby step, but, you know, that's a step forward.
I agree with you. So when I introduced this item, I talked about the three sort of steps. Well, step one was data, step two is research, step three is action. We can affect, like you're suggesting, we can affect the data as an agency. Potentially as board members, you can affect the research step. You know, and potentially maybe we can too, maybe a little less so. I'm speaking of your network in each of your specific locations. You've lived in Santa Barbara. You're looking at me funny. You've lived in Santa Barbara a long time.
I'm just adjusting my glasses.
Okay.
Nothing else is intact.
Okay. No, I'm just getting that elaborate look.
if I take them off, and I would see very clearly. This sometimes is a little too short.
So, what did you mean by that,
John? Exactly. Can I add something before we get to this? It's not a non sequitur, but I just want to make sure it's in everyone's picture, and that is there. You know, getting back to the big societal issue that this presents, there is a very strong and sound movement in green chemistry. The first green chemistry textbook was probably written in the last decade, and I know that it's now become part of the curriculum at some of the leading universities, both here and in England. As the co-authors, one was I believe, out of Harvard, the other one out of a leading university and in the UK. And I mean, what that says to me is what they are training young scientists to consider the consequences of one constituent over another in terms of what they're designing and the compounds they're selecting. And, you know, the classic example being red dye number two. I mean, if there was something else, if you knew that it was harmful, what could you substitute that would achieve the outcome that you want? And the impetus behind this was that the view was that they felt that chemists, in particular, had this kind of partition. It's like, well, it doesn't matter to me. I'm just doing something, designing something, manufacturing something, and it's not my problem what the consequences are. I'm just trying to make it cheap and effective. And there is an effort to shift the philosophy behind how we actually, you know, how we invent and think about creating new solutions that can actually cause more problems than they solve. So I personally was, you know, buoyed to know that we're at least going to crank out new generations of scientists that think differently. It's another dimension.
But, you know, to get back a little bit to Mike's comment earlier, you know, he was saying, well, you know, when you take the pharmaceutical, you know, medications, a lot of it passes through your body, so the impact of proper disposal of excess medication doesn't have too much of an effect. But I think one thing to keep in mind is that the potency is 100%, whereas if you take medication and you have the right dosage, some of it is going to be metabolized in your system. So there is a benefit there. And one other thing I thought about is, you know, about if and this would be have to be encouraged again at the state level rather than our level when I talked about the pharmaceutical board, is encouraging where the packaging would have a notice encouraging recycling, you know, proper disposal. Because right now when you get your medication, you know, there's do's and don'ts, take it, you know, before lunch, after lunch, or whatever. But there's nothing else. Whereas if there was some labeling, you know, as a reminder to people, you know, please, you know, dispose of the excess. You know, those are the little baby steps that maybe are helpful for consumers to be more recognizant of it. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, I think those are all good suggestions. I just want to express concern anytime we start on a new venture, if we might now on this. It's of course has an impact on staff, and it's really easy for us to come up with good ideas, and it's hard for them to implement them given what they're already doing. So if we move ahead in any way on this, I think it'd be nice to get back from staff a summary roadmap of where this might lead to an outcome and how much each of the steps on the roadmap might take staff so that we can see a bigger picture than today being an informational item before we give them any in-depth direction. And the other comment I want to make is back to the toilet tissue issue. There's a lot of issues around our waste that we as a society are not very open-minded to thinking about. So, for instance, today we're thinking anything that we ingest has to end up in our sewage system. And so it's going to be difficult to deal with these prostrate chemicals and other hormonal chemical issues. But, you know, composting toilets and where that goes, you know, in the end, if we're going to have a political revolution like Bernie Sanders says, you know, we need to be open-minded to revolutions of different things than just policies. And what we do with our everyday lifestyle that contributes to these large impacts, we should be open-minded to thinking about what has been done for thousands of years, what is being done today in other countries, and whether our roadmap can include suggesting other ways of doing things. You know, that's down the road in a roadmap, I'm sure. But I think it's up to all of our responsibilities to be open-minded and considering in our own lives and the lives that we are engaged with other people what we might do to help the problem. Because I think we can be closed-minded sometimes to how we live our lives and what our contribution is.
Okay, thank you, Bruce. I think that's important, and I'm sort of sensitive to the workload issues as well. I mean, in terms of what our board really has jurisdiction over, and you know, we don't have a record right now, so I think this USGS study is a really good opportunity to start building that record and collecting the data towards the overall aim of some regulatory, and I think we need state leadership much more than they have been in the past on this issue, because it's really large and involves a number of different corporations and oligarchies. So I would, I think we need to raise it to that level, but I don't think we're there yet, and I don't want our board to get sort of distracted with this issue when we don't have the opportunity to affect that near-term change. But I'm interested to see how the USGS data is collected and what comes out of that.
Well, I would only say, in terms of low-hanging fruit, putting Dr. Wolf's suggestion about labeling forward to the legislative thinking that goes on at state board and what we push forward, that one seems like a no-brainer. And I would think, if it hasn't already been put on the list, it should be on the list. And that's simply a memo saying, This is what came out of our hearing. We suggest the state board push on legislation to require all pharmaceuticals, prescription-issued pharmaceuticals, carry a label that says, do not throw into a sink or a toilet as disposal, or, you know, find a way to recycle it. I don't know what the language would be. I'm just saying, I think that one's an easy one.
Yeah, and we do have some mechanism, Jane, without ourselves, you know, putting all the burden on our shoulders, is that, you know, there are monthly chairs, calls, you have the EOS meetings, and, you know, the discussions are not always exclusively about, hey, what did you regulate last week, but more, hey, where we go, you know, forward thinking. And, you know, in fact, at the upcoming WQCC, there will be a presentation including actually chemicals emerging concern that's going to be part of the conversation. And yeah, you know, when we talk about this thing, doesn't mean next week. You know, like, for example, with legislative actions, you know, the train left the station. So, you know, we're talking now 2017, 2018 for some of those things. But this is the kind of dialogue and, you know, that we have right now in thinking. It's like, okay, yeah, these are areas to move forward to.
Yeah, I think there's a strong way that we can advocate for that, both at the regional board level and at the state level. I don't want to, you know, overburden our staff with things that we don't have enough data to support. I mean, clearly there's enough data nationwide to support, and I guess I'm sort of discouraged that there's enough data to this point that nobody's done anything. So to the extent that we can raise that and use our voices in a productive manner in that way, just to amplify the information that is out there, I think we should do that.
You know, I think in terms of monitoring, because I'm sort of partway between Mr. Young and Ms. Gray on that, I think we do have probably a more robust surface water monitoring program going than most, if not all, of the other regions. And there would be some efficiencies to trying to use that to do some of this monitoring. At the same time, I agree with Ms. Gray that the USGS is going to do this project where they're going to monitor for a huge number of analytes, test for a huge number of analytes. I think we should make sure that we have some input, and it sounds like we're doing that, into their monitoring locations, and we should look at the data we get back afterwards, and then I think it's the time to discuss whether there's a cost-efficient and time-efficient way for us to piggyback onto our existing monitoring program, the way we're starting to do with some things like the pyrethroids and the microcystin. You know, whether we want to, at some sites, monitor for some constituents based on what we learn from the extensive monitoring the USGS is going to be doing. It seems pointless to start that right now. I mean, we're just about to get a bunch of data that could really guide us. And then I think is when we have the conversation of whether it makes sense to get some guidance on that, you know, which is probably 8 or 10 months out once that is completed.
And I think we should give guidance. I'm just not prepared to do that now, and I don't think anybody is, but I'm all, yeah, yes.
As a reminder, this is an informational, educational meeting, and, you know, so, and yes, sometimes we have a tendency of, you know, saying, okay, let's move on. But I think that, at least speaking for myself, you know, I learned a lot today, and I surely appreciate that, and I think it elevates our understanding and also kind of seeing in the horizon, okay, where could we go from here? And there's there's one or two low-hanging fruits, and we put that on the shoulder of Tom Howard, you know, and if we have enough region, by the way, you know, it's just a few calls with the other chairs, and we kind of rally, and we get VEOs to give us high five and say, let's do it. You know, we can get things done, right?
Yeah. I'm a fan of the get a multitude of regions and form an insurrection strategy. You know, I think that's where we bring pressure. This affects every region, too. I mean, Jessica and I were joking during this item that she gets the water before the tunnels get the water, before we get the water. So she's to blame, pretty much.
All right. So let's see. Any parting comments? Nope. That's a high five. Oh, you like that.
Thank you.
Yeah. I just wanted to say thank you to Harvey, because on two levels, it's hard to give a presentation when you're not an expert on it. It's really hard, and you have to learn so much. And this was an obtuse object that Harvey got assigned here, and he did a great job learning along the way. And I just really appreciate the effort that he did on this, because this is not any of our mainstay in terms of technical background, you know, so it was a tough one to get your arms around.
But once in a while, it's healthy to be put outside of our comfort zone.
We learn a lot that way, but it's a lot of work, too.
So in 8 months, Harvey, we're going to direct you to do more things, I suppose. You can start building your knowledge base, but thank you. I know this is a little bit amorphous, but it's horribly frightening when you read all of this. I know maybe we shouldn't be frightened, but over decades of accumulation, yeah, I think we should be frightened. So I appreciate it, and I look forward to getting some direction when we have better information.
So to your point, John, Mr. Robertson, is there any way in which our staff can begin to integrate this into their work? Are there aspects of this, aside from the monitoring, of course, but are there aspects of this where you see potential for, in the course of doing what they do, not adding, but putting a new lens on work that's already being done?
So with the landfill program, I'll speak from some of my own personal experience when I was a groundwater section manager. In the landfill program, we had a dialogue going with San Luis Obispo County about the don't flush it, don't put it in your landfill, return it to your pharmacy ordinance development. And that's a really local approach, but, I'm not a fan of the, throw up your hands and we can't do anything victim narrative. I don't like that. I don't subscribe to that. I don't want us to build a culture of that. And we don't have a culture of that in our office. That was Taya Tryon working with some folks in San Luis Obispo County. And I don't know where we're at in that process. I know the pharmacy near my house has that notice available on it, but I don't know if we actually have ordinance in San Luis Obispo County on that. But that's an example of how it could be integrated into the program level work,
Okay. So if we don't have any more comments, perhaps, we could then move to the next item. And